All right, welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. This now is officially Question Medicine 2.0. There is going to be so many changes in 2020. Some will be good, some will be bad. I cannot tell you which will be which. So you got to let me know, what do you like? What changes do you like? I can tell you one of the best changes I probably did in 2019 came from you, the listener. And one of you said, hey, you go through a lot of articles, and by the end of it, I can't really remember what you all talked about. Could you just do a quick recap at the very end? And so that way I know what you said. I know what you did. I can refresh my memory. And I thought about it, and I put it into place, and I've never looked back. And that was a great change, but it came from you. And I can promise you that some of the changes I'm going to implement into the podcast in 2020 may or may not be beneficial for you, the listener. And that's really all that matters, is you, the listener, what do you like to hear? So if there's something that you like, please let me know. If there's something you don't like, please let me know. Andrew Bilt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com. And with that, without any further hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, Question Medicine listeners, 2020, so many changes to the podcast. If you like it, if you don't like it, let me know. And if you like it, then tell a friend, because there's no better way to spread the medical information, to spread the knowledge, than to tell a friend. So let's look at our first article. The first article is in Annals of Internal Medicine. It is something that pretty much every time I give a lecture, I preach on. And that is, we have no strict criteria for what is a conflict of interest. It says, I have no relative conflicts of interest to give to the audience, or I have no relevant conflicts of interest. What does relevant even mean? I mean, relevant is just that. It's relevant to the individual writing the slide. Well, I can tell you that if you take $1 million from Roche and you're giving a lecture, or you're going to talk about something for the evidence around AstraZeneca, well, I think that you're probably going to be a little biased, whether you believe it or not. If a pen, a simple pen given to a physician, makes them prescribe the drug more often, well, then I can tell you that $1 million or $5 or even a $20 meal ticket, we know, changes the prescribing patterns. So what does conflict of interest mean? And in this article, Annals of Internal Medicine, disclosure form for work submitted to medical journals, it's a proposal by the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors. Who even knew that was a thing? But in this, these Committee of Medical Journal Editors, they basically say what I just said, that there are so many things that will affect you that they report certain pieces of information. And some people, they just flat out lie to you and they don't disclose their information for fear that there will be some sort of pushback from the audience or those individuals trying to read the paper. Nonetheless, disagreement, confusion, controversy, or just straight out lying, there are people out there that are not reporting their relationships or their activities. So in this paper, this International Committee of Medical Journal Editors have come up with a solution, and I think it's quite frankly fantastic, and it will be coming to a paper near you. The solution is for disclosure of potential conflicts of interest is now going to say the disclosure form, meaning we don't think it's potential conflicts of interest. We just want to know, what are you disclosing? Anything, everything. And then we're taking out the word potential, because potential is potentially open to interpretation, and that's the one thing we don't want. The other solution they have here is that the authors disclose their relationships and activities to the readers and then let the readers decide. It's not up to the author to decide what is a potential conflict of interest, and that's why they're taking potential out of the word. It's just a disclosure form. The authors are to disclose to the reader, and then the reader gets to make up their mind what they think is right and what they think is wrong. We report, you decide. I think that is some network's slogan, isn't it? Now, I believe it was Zig Ziglar, or it was some speaker somewhere at some point in time, who said, I speak at a fifth grade reading level because even lawyers can understand me. Well, this next paper talks just about that. It is patient comprehension of common orthopedic terminology. You see, we as physicians, we as providers, we overestimate the health literacy of our patients. We think, oh, they're here. They seem somewhat well put together. They're in the doctor's office. They must know what I'm talking about. Unfortunately, whether they do or don't, or whether they have a high intellectual capability or a low intellectual capability, usually they're coming to us at one of the most scared and frightened moments of their life. And so even if you speak at a first grade reading level, most of the words go right over their head. And that is clearly shown in this article of ED patients with orthopedic injuries. It was 150 patients in the ED and 150 patients in the orthopedic inpatient service, so 300 patients in total. Over half of these individuals had a college education, and that's important because listen to what I'm about to tell you. They gave these 300 people who had an orthopedic injury a 12-question multiple-choice test, and about 40% could not tell you that a fracture was the same thing as a broken bone. They had an orthopedic injury. They were seeing a physician who I can guarantee you thought that they perfectly described what was going on to the patient. The patient nodded and said, yep, that makes sense. And 40% didn't know that a fracture was the same thing as a broken bone. And 50% thought a fracture was not as bad as a broken bone. So 50% thought, oh, whew, good thing I only have a fracture and not a broken bone because fractures are not nearly as bad. And maybe the scariest part about all this is that only 20% could tell you what a fracture is. Remember, these are individuals who have orthopedic injuries. They are seeing physicians who are supposed to be describing things to them, and they couldn't tell you what a fracture was. And if you're sending a patient home with, I don't know, a fractured foot or something that needs non-weight bearing, well, 20% of the individuals in this study could not understand in a multiple choice question what non-weight bearing meant. That means one in five patients you send home that you think you're doing a really good job with don't understand non-weight bearing means not weight bearing. Think about that for a second and understand that our patients, although they try, they do try. They're not dumb at all. In fact, if anything, there are two individuals in the room, the patient and yourself, and only one individual has the knowledge to explain to the other individual. And when they leave the room, it looks like about 50% of the time, the patient still has no idea what we're saying. We have to dumb it down. We have to dumb it down to even a level that we cannot comprehend because I can tell you there is no way that these individuals that were being interviewed had providers who thought, oh, yeah, I did a terrible job of explaining that one. There's no way they're going to understand it. Hopefully that was a simple breakdown of that article that you could understand to change your practice. Let's move on. Next article. Boom. We know that more pills people are supposed to take, the more likely they're going to be non-compliant. We know that the more vaccines that patients are supposed to get, the more likely they're not going to follow up or they're going to be non-compliant. They're just not going to get all the vaccines necessary. They're not going to take all the pills every single time because they just don't do it. Well, currently the CDC recommends two HPV vaccinations for vaccinated children between 9 and 14 years old and three doses for those individuals vaccinated later. But this next paper, which is comparison of long-term impact on clinical outcomes of fewer doses and standard doses of human papillomavirus virus in the United States, a database study, used insurance claims database and matched nearly 70,000 women age 9 to 26 and received at least one dose of the quadrivalent HPV vaccine with all 70,000 unvaccinated controls. And when you looked at the rates of pre-invasive cervical disease at 5 years, it was 2.6 in the unvaccinated group versus 1.6 among those individuals who only received one vaccine. Yes, a 1% difference, absolute difference. That's a number needed to treat of 100. And it gets really interesting in this next statement. Remember, it was 2.6 in the unvaccinated, but it was 1.9% in those that received two doses of the vaccine and 1.86 for those individuals that had three doses of the vaccine. But remember, it was 1.6 in only 1%. The numbers didn't vary is what I'm trying to get out of here. One vaccine, two vaccines, three vaccines. There was really no statistical difference there. And so maybe, just maybe, one is good enough. There was a 36% reduction in pre-invasive cervical disease for those individuals that had a one-time HPV vaccine and a 34% reduction in those individuals that had three HPV vaccines. It seems that just maybe, one HPV vaccine is good enough. And now let's move on to an article that is so popular in the press, so popular among your patients that I just have to talk about it. And normally, I don't talk about articles that are in the press because, quite frankly, they're just terrible articles. The methods are completely flawed. The way they did it is completely flawed. And usually the conclusion is not at all what the paper actually said if you actually read the paper. But in 2020, I'm going to try to touch on the articles that are hot in the press because I think that those are the articles that likely your patients are going to ask you about. So as best I can, I will try to swallow my every bit of evidence-based practice and life and touch on these articles and give you my take, my two cents, my opinion on what I think they got wrong, what I think they got right, and what I think it means for your practice. So, moving forward, it is a paper in JAMA titled Effect of Sunscreen Application on Plasma Concentration of Sunscreen Active Ingredients, a Randomized Clinical Trial. In this study, they took 48 healthy participants and they wanted to test what was the plasma concentration of six sunscreen active ingredients from four commercially available sunscreen products. And I'm sure you have already seen the results of this study. It made big headlines, but the take-home was that the mean maximum plasma concentration of all six ingredients, and I could say all six, but honestly, I'll probably mispronounce most of them, exceeded the threshold of 0.5 nanograms per milliliter after a single application on day one. AKA, that means that the sunscreen got absorbed through the skin and the chemical got into the blood. Everyone's freaking out and they're saying, oh my goodness, these are chemicals that are not, they're in our blood and they're not supposed to be in our blood. This is so terrible. What are we doing? This isn't all natural and this isn't organic and this isn't super healthy. But the question is, does this matter? The answer is, I have absolutely no idea because we don't know what concentrations of these chemicals at small quantities, such as 7 nanograms per milliliter, does to the body. The FDA even came out and said, we need more studies at this time because in this study, there was no appreciable or notable harms. No harms. We don't really know. We know it's there, but we don't know what to make of it. Now, the American Cancer Society estimates that in 2020, about 100,000 new melanomas will be diagnosed, and about 7,000 deaths are expected due to melanoma. There is strong evidence that the use of sunscreen reduces the risk of squamous cell carcinoma by about 40% and reduces the risk of melanomas by about 50%. So in the end, we have a treatment that prevents cancer. Sunscreen. And a very, very small amount of this treatment in the chemical compounds can be detected in the blood once you use this treatment. But we have no idea what that chemical compound in your blood actually means. Is it good? Is it bad? And just maybe, I'm just going to throw it out there. Maybe it's the chemical compounds in the blood that actually prevent the melanoma. I know it's not likely, but we have no idea. We have no idea. And for me, I will take a chance. But if you won't and you say, listen, sunscreen's not for me, I don't want these chemical compounds that I can't even pronounce in my blood, well, then okay, I understand that. Just encourage your patient to use other sun protection strategies like wide-brimmed hats, protective clothing, avoiding midday sun, wearing sunglasses, and seeking the shade whenever possible. Whew, that was a lot for me to handle. I don't know if I can do those again in the future, but I will certainly try. And with that, on to the next article. And that's the warning sign, that's the bell, that's the cue that this is going to be the last article. Again, that's going to be new for 2020. If you like it, let me know. If you don't, let me know. But that's what I need to know. And this next one is a good one. I've saved it for last. And it honestly really disappoints me. It's from UpToDate. From UpToDate, you say? Yes, it's from UpToDate. Now, let's just talk about this. I think UpToDate is a wonderful resource. If you're in a need, if you're in a hurry, if you need to look something up, it's a wonderful resource. And I understand that we don't have time to go into the original research from up to date. And that's why you listen to podcasts, because you don't have time to go read every single article from up to date. But it usually summarizes it quite nicely. And you say, huh, okay, I've learned something. Well, then I got this message from up to date. And they say, hey, we're going to recommend Tamiflu. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, what are they even talking about? That doesn't make any sense to me. And then I looked at the new update from UpToDate, and I'm going to read it, quote, just word for word, because I think it is so important that it needs to be read word for word. Here we go. When indicated, antiviral therapy for seasonal influenza should be administered as soon as possible, since it confers the greatest benefit within the first 24 hours of illness. Sidebar, I will totally agree with that. It does confer the biggest benefit within the first 48 hours, but the benefit's still really small, but it is definitely the biggest benefit in the first 48 hours. Carry on. However, treatment after this interval can still be beneficial. In a randomized open-label European trial, adding oseltamivir to usual care reduced symptom duration among outpatients 1 year of age and older with influenza-like illness compared with placebo, even among those with symptom duration greater than 48 hours. For adults greater than 65 years old with comorbidities and moderate to severe symptoms, oseltamivir was estimated to reduce symptoms by 2.3 to 3.2 days if started 48 to 72 hours after symptom onset. These data support our approach to provide antiviral therapy to patients with severe or risk factors for complications, regardless of illness duration. Oh my goodness, it took me so hard to not just vomit halfway through that, but let's go into what they're talking about. Because I read that and I thought to myself, whoa, just a second. I am so far behind the times. How did I miss this? How did I, your humble host, who has kind of a passion for the lack of use of Tamiflu and how, oseltamivir, but Tamiflu and how it wasn't beneficial, how the drug company knew it wasn't beneficial, and that's why they wouldn't hand over their information. How did I miss this? How did I ever miss this? So I did what I always do, and I went to the original research because I was going to read it all because I wanted to know maybe, just maybe, it's kind of beneficial at 48 hours, and maybe it now is actually beneficial up to 72. I found it so hard to believe. It was barely beneficial at 48 hours. How is this possible? Well, I went to the paper. The paper is in Lancet, 2020, January 4th. Oseltamivir plus usual care versus usual care for influenza-like illness in primary care, an open-label, pragmatic, randomized control trial. Let's break down what all of this means. But let's first break down the study. The main objective of the trial was to determine whether adding antiviral treatment to best usual primary care is effective in reducing time to return to usual daily activity, aka is giving Tamiflu beneficial in getting the patient back to usual daily activity. Now, this was a randomized control trial. Yes, it was a randomized control trial, but it wasn't a blinded trial. No, they did an open label, meaning the patients knew what they were on, pragmatic, adaptive, randomized control trial of adding oseltamivir to usual care in patients 1 year of old, 1 year of age and older, and then the other group got nothing. So here's what happened. You came in with flu-like symptoms. That's important. We're going to talk about it in a second. And you either got Tamiflu, open label, meaning you knew you were getting treatment. You knew you were getting something, or you just got usual care. This wasn't a test to see if Tamiflu was better. This was a test to see if just giving medication was better. We know that in randomized control trials, blinded trials, Tamiflu really isn't beneficial. In fact, you could argue whether it's really beneficial at all, but certainly not past 48 hours. In the study, when it was open label, the patients did better, but the other group didn't get anything. It was just usual care. And remember, this was flu-like illness, not actually influenza. In fact, when you dug into the supplementary data, PCR evidence for influenza was only positive in 50% in each group of those individuals that were randomized, meaning half the time the people didn't even have influenza. So not only can I tell you almost 100% for certain that Tamiflu isn't that beneficial, it's almost certainly not beneficial if you don't actually have influenza. I mean, that's what the drug is for. And I can't think of any other drug in which we would do this kind of trial. I mean, can you think of a drug where we'd be like, well, you're coming in with symptoms that kind of resemble breast cancer, so we're gonna go ahead and just start giving you chemo and radiation. How's that sound? Even though we don't really know. No, that is absolutely ludicrous. You can't do that. And let's not forget, the harms of Tamiflu, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, they're somewhere in the range of 1 in 20, 1 in 25, depending where you're looking, depending on which Cochrane review you're reading. This was an open label, non-blinded trial. That doesn't look at the effects of Tamiflu. That looks at the effects of a placebo. And if you wanted to run a study that said, we ran a study and it determines that if you give people a placebo, they actually do better. Well, no kidding, Sherlock. We know placebos work. But that doesn't mean that Tamiflu works, because you didn't blind the study and you gave people medications for 50% of them didn't even have that illness. Ugh, the frustration. And with that, we'll end this episode. We'll wrap this one up. We'll end this one like we've ended every one before it. Here we go in 30 seconds or less. At the very beginning of this, I talked about the new conflicts of interest coming out by the International Committee of Medical Journals and Editors. And basically, their solution is it's no longer a potential of conflicts interest form. It is now just a disclosure form. You just got to disclose everything. You disclose and let the people decide. Orthopedic terminology, well, it turns out that our patients, even when about half of them are college educated, don't know the difference between a fracture and a broken bone. Don't know that it's the same. One in five of them cannot understand non-weight bearing. We need to spell these things out for these people, and that's okay. We just need to know that we need to do it. Giving one HPV vaccine seems to be more beneficial than giving no vaccines, but definitely not worse than giving two or three. So if you're going to get one vaccine, that's probably good enough. If your patient will take two, that's good. If they will take the full recommendations, that's great. But one seems to be A-okay, at least for the outcome of pre-invasive cervical disease. If your patient comes into the office and they're asking about sunblock and they want to know, what about the sunblock? What should I do? Well, just remind them that right around 7,000 people are going to die this year alone of melanoma, and right around 100,000 people are going to be diagnosed with a new melanoma. So for me, I'm willing to take the risk. Maybe they're not. And if they're not, just encourage them to use other sun protection strategy. And last but not least, UpToDate is great. UpToDate is awesome, except UpToDate's not always accurate. And some of the information they use is really terrible, like a non-blinded study on Tamiflu at 48 to 72 hours. Yes, I know UpToDate says, go ahead and do this. But I will tell you, do not do that. That is just not worth it. And with that, I will end this podcast as I ended every single one before it.
So here we go. Wait for the music. All right, there it is. So until next time, keep the quest and questioning.